At some point in our school years, you and I learned about Charles Darwin and how he discovered that species evolve. And I think for most of us, our study of evolution probably ended right about there. But for others, like our guest today, they have devoted their lives to that field of research. And even if our science knowledge might be a little rusty, there are some great examples, some fascinating examples that we can all appreciate. My next guest, Christopher Balakrishnan, is an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at East Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina, and he'll be one of the featured speakers at the Darwin Day event later this week. And Chris, thank you so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to have this opportunity.
Well, we hear a lot about evolution and Darwin's theories of how species have adapted to survive and thrive. But I'm not sure we all have a good sense of how it actually happens. How do those traits emerge as useful and then get passed through generations?
Sure. Yeah, so the wonderful thing about evolution and studying evolution is really that you can observe it all around you. And so anything you look at is evolving. And really the key to evolution is variation in the population. And if you look at look at human people, there's all this variation. And it's that variation that natural selection acts on, particularly the component of that variation that is controlled by your genes. So there has to be variation, and that variation has to be heritable. And that's really the root of evolution by natural selection.
Okay. What about changing habitat? Maybe accessibility to mates?
Absolutely. And so that's where the selective pressures come from. So if that variation, depending on what type of variation you have in your physiology, your how pretty you are, those traits might make you more or less able to be successful if you move into a new environment. So you can think of birds colonizing islands as being a major change in the environment that they are now exposed to. And the individuals that have the phenotypes that have the ecological traits that allow them to do better, those are the ones who will do well on the islands, and those are the ones who will reproduce the most, and therefore those traits will become more common in the future generations.
Yeah. Well, the theme of this year's Darwin Day event is Alien Invasions, Evolutions of Real-Life Body Snatchers. It's a pretty interesting title.
That's a fun one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's going to take a close look at the evolution of parasites, organisms that have evolved to invade other organisms' bodies. And so maybe talk about parasites in general a little bit with us.
Yeah, so parasites are sort of one of the classic scenarios in which a person can study evolution, because parasites impose this strong selection pressure on the organisms that they interact with. You can think of any kind of parasite, from a bacterial a parasite to a viral parasite. What I study, which is probably the parasite that people don't think about, is avian parasites or bird parasites. So these are not birds that attack you and try to suck your blood or anything like that. What they are is birds that, instead of building their own nests and raising their own young, they lay their eggs in the nest of a different bird species and essentially forces that species to raise their young. So they're parasitizing these hosts in the sense that they're taking advantage of them and forcing them to raise their young.
Isn't that amazing? That's a really interesting, fascinating area of research. I think I'm trying to think of birds native to Wisconsin, like cowbirds would be.
That's the classic one. And for North America, that's the most common one, and that's the one the listeners are going to have seen, because they're very abundant in everywhere, basically, in the U.S., and in the Midwest in particular.
Ah, and just as an aside, how are you studying them, and in what ways do you study them?
So I do a lot of different things. On the one hand, I'm interested in behavior, so I do things like song recordings and compare songs among species to learn how songs themselves evolve. I also do a lot of genetic work. So these days for evolutionary biology, a lot of what people do is use molecular genetics to reconstruct the history of evolution. So you can take your species of interest and sequence a part of its DNA, or even now you can sequence whole genomes,
yeah.
And you can compare those genomes across species and really understand how species are changing at the genetic level. And in doing so, you get both a sense of what's different, what might make a bluebird blue or a green bird green, and also you also get a sense of the timing that over which evolution has taken place. How closely related are different species? And that allows you to make predictions about what environmental factors have led to diversification of particular species or group of species.
Christopher Balakrishna, our guest today, he is an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at Eastern Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina, and is one of the featured speakers at the Darwin Day event later this week. Great to have him along. You may have some questions about evolutionary biology, and I hope you'll join in. Let me give the number. I haven't done that yet. It's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, one of the ways that I find really fascinating the way that parasites evolve is to live off another creature, but not really kill it. And I can remember seeing some video footage of some insects in the Amazon that live off a tree. They eat the sap and so forth out of the tree, but of course they don't want to kill it. And if you attack the tree, if you go to chop it or something, they will attack you and probably kill you.
Yeah, so that idea that a parasite might not benefit from killing its host is a really important one. In fact, that itself is a trait that can evolve. So what we call that is really virulence. So some parasites have chosen a strategy where they are very bad for their host, and sometimes the hosts die. And other parasites are relatively mild, and they're less virulent, and they more coexist in this kind of scenario like you were talking about, where they benefit, they get a benefit from the host, but they don't impose too strong of a cost on that host on which they exist.
Yeah. Well, is one of the ways that parasites evolve is to find a way to live off another creature then, but not kill it. Pretty important for the parasite, not to mention the host.
That's right. The one thing that sort of counteracts that is if there are lots of hosts. So if a parasite is easily able to jump from one host to another, then it might be okay from the parasite's point of view, of course, for the host to die. If the host is dying and there's enough of an opportunity for that parasite to jump to another one, then that might be evolutionarily favored. So you do see parasites that are very bad for their hosts, but that's certainly not always the case, because in some cases, then the host can die, then the parasite dies along with it, and then no one wins.
Yeah. Well, you're going to be talking specifically about parasitic birds in your talk on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. A lot of Darwin's research focused on birds, did it not?
They did. And what I'm going to do in my talk is tell you that those Darwin's finches that you always hear about are nothing compared to brood parasitic birds in terms of evolution and how crazy adaptation and evolution by natural selection can be. The birds that Darwin's finches are probably the birds that people often think of when they hear about evolution and Darwin. And I'm going to talk about another group of finches, and these are brood parasitic finches that are native to Africa. And so those are the birds that I do a lot of work on, and that's at least part of what I'm going to talk about.
Oh, well, and they're in Africa, you say? So you study them in Africa?
That's right. So starting in graduate school, I started working on these birds, and then I took a few years break, and now that I've started my own research group here at East Carolina, I just went back to Cameroon in West Africa for the first time in a few years, but to work on these birds, yeah.
Yeah, and again, give me the definition of a parasitic bird.
So these are birds that instead of building their own nest and raising their own young, They lay their eggs in the nest of a different bird species that then raise their young. So some brood parasitic birds are what we call obligate brood parasites. And what that means is that they never build a nest. They never, ever build a nest and raise their own young. And in North America, cowbirds are like that. And in Africa, the birds that I study, the indigo birds, are like that. So they never build a nest, and they choose a host to raise their young. One of the big differences between cowbirds and the birds that I study is that cowbirds here in North America are known to parasitize over 200 hosts. So they lay their eggs kind of anywhere. And indigo birds that I study, each species of indigo bird is adapted to parasitize a specific host. So for each species of indigo bird, it has one host where it lays its eggs.
Very interesting. Gordon in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind? Oops, let me see. Hold, let me, there, now I've got, I'm sorry, Garden. What's on your mind?
Yeah, my question is, when everybody talks of evolution, they talk of things evolving. They never go back to the original fact that life comes from an egg and a seed. How in the world could that be explained in evolution? That was my question.
All right.
Yeah, so one of the biggest and hardest questions in evolutionary biology is what started it all in motion? I think nowadays it's for us it's very easy to go into the lab and see evolution if we put birds in a novel environment or fish into a new pond. The difficult question is how did it all start? And there's theories about this, and one of the theories that I'm going to teach my class about is that in my lecture that I give this afternoon is about what's called the RNA world hypothesis. And that's the idea that cellular life started from a situation where there was just RNA. So RNA is part of the genetic makeup of organisms, and RNA is capable of replicating just by itself. And so one hypothesis is that from an RNA-centered world, we just had replicating RNA that moved to DNA that was contained within cells that then went to replicating cells and that all the way to what we see now, complex reproduction like sexual reproduction and things like that. Hmm. So that's what scientists are thinking these days. And though it's absolutely correct that nailing down how that all exactly happened on day one is non-trivial.
For sure. Christopher Balakrishnan, our guest today, and he's going to be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we will be right back with Christopher. Please stay with us. It's amazing to think that species can adapt to changing conditions and habitats to improve their chances of surviving. And, of course, it can take millions of years to get there, but the fact is that there's a richness and diversity of life on Earth that proves that it's been successful for many, many creatures, and that a lot of times the adaptation can come pretty quickly. Larry Mueller here, great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Christopher Balakrishnan is an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at Eastern Carolina University in Greenville, North Carolina, and one of the featured speakers at the Darwin Day event later this week. And Chris, great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for taking the time.
My pleasure, and I'm having a great time so far.
Yeah, well, Gordon in Milwaukee had asked you about how did we evolve to be the product of an egg and a seed, you know, sort of like what came, how did these things develop? And you talked about one theory, and maybe let's go back to that for a minute.
Sure.
So we were talking about RNA.
Right. So most of you might know that within each of your cells we have DNA, and DNA contains the information that goes into, in fact, building you. So it contains the genes that encode the proteins, that encode all of the stuff that makes up an organism. In addition to DNA, what you also have in your cells is RNA. And so DNA is, in fact, converted into RNA. And RNA is kind of the active form of DNA. DNA kind of sits there, doesn't really do anything, but it has the information. And when particular genes are turned on, what you see the next step is that you have RNA. Okay, and then RNA in turn goes on to make the proteins that do all the stuff. Okay, those are the players I was discussing. And one idea is that life started simply from replicating RNA. So RNA has both the information to store information, like DNA does, and it has the information, the ability to do catalytic activities, to do stuff like proteins do. And because it has this multiplicity of function, one idea is that RNA could do a lot of the basics, namely replicating itself, that reflect what we think early life was like. So early life is nothing like what we think of as life now. It could be as simple as replicating RNA.
Interesting. Well,
am I still on yet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I could understand that, but my question again is what drove the whole process to the extent that a male and a female was created to create life again. If life was existing or expanding from that type of theory, what drove everything to a male and a female in every species?
Okay.
So the way I would answer that is simply to say that it's actually not all species do we have male and females. Only in a subset of species. In many forms of life, we have one species, and those things reproduce asexually, clonally. They just make copies of each other. And so in some forms of life, still, we see things that are very similar to that RNA world that I described. Things like viruses, if you consider those to be alive, they have a very much simpler lifestyle than what we have with sexual reproduction. Even among things that you might think of are just like us that have males and females, they don't always. Things like fish, things like lizards, you see examples of parthenogenesis where one individual just splits to form two, essentially.
Thanks for calling, Gordon. I appreciate your call. I want to go back to your research because you study indigo birds in, if I'm not, is that the name of the bird? Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah, indigo birds in South Africa. Now, are they obligate birds? You talked about one type of bird is an obligate bird that never builds its own nest.
Yeah, that's right. So they are obligate brood parasites. So they, as far as we know, they are never going to build a nest. They just dump their eggs off in somebody else's nest. And these birds, actually, you can find them all throughout Africa, everywhere south of the Sahara. So anywhere that's for most of Africa, you can find indigo birds doing their parasitic thing.
And so there's another type of parasitic bird that does not, that will occasionally build its own nest or sometimes does?
Yeah, so this you see in some species of ducks, for example, where just occasionally a female will just lay her eggs in the nest of a different species, but then she will also have her own nest that where she raises the young.
Yeah, it really interesting.
And so we call that facultative parasitism. It's basically just optional. So they're using multiple different strategies to reproduce. Whereas in some birds, like the cowbirds and the indigo birds, they've totally given up on this whole parental care, nest building, all of the steps that go into raising a young. These birds don't do it. And the idea is that that's saving them, you know, a whole bunch of effort. So they don't have to invest in building a nest. They don't have to feed their young. That behavior of feeding young is incredibly costly for a parent, as probably everybody who has children knows.
Yeah.
And so they've just taken a shortcut, and that shortcut has proven successful for them.
Chris Marlin Krishna, our guest today, an assistant professor in the Department of Biology at Eastern Carolina University. He's going to be speaking at the Darwin Day event later this week as we talk with him about evolutionary biology and Darwin Day. And looking forward to your questions or comments as we move along today. The number for you to call, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. What questions do you have about evolutionary biology? What's been your experience and what interest do you have So these obligate birds, how does, you wonder, how does the heck does how did indigo birds develop in that way? I mean, it's.
Yeah. So one of the things I wanted, so I've mentioned cowbirds and indigo birds as two examples of this obligate brood parasitism. What's really amazing, and what I'll talk about in on Friday during Darwin Day, is that this behavior has actually evolved in birds 7 times independently.
Wow.
7 different groups of birds that have evolved this strategy. And one of the ideas about how that happened is you know, I talked about the facultative brood parasitism, where it's an option.
Right.
One of the options is you go through these transition stages where maybe they started by doing a facultative brood parasitism, where they only sometimes laid their eggs in other birds' nests. And then from there, it's not such a big step to just give up the whole childcare thing completely and become the lazy birds that indigo birds are.
It's really quite interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I guess sure. Why wouldn't it have started maybe with one, you know, once in a while, and then
to tie it all together, I guess I mentioned the idea of these costs and benefits and how you're saving energy by not building a nest and taking care of young. The other part of that is if you're not putting all that energy into doing that, you also might be able to lay more eggs. So you take that cost savings and then you reapply it, you spend it producing more eggs or something like that. So by not building a nest and raising young, you're saving all this energy that you can use for other purposes that are to your advantage.
Yeah, and for us here in Wisconsin and well elsewhere too, I think for me, it's kind of sad to see you got some little tiny sparrow trying to feed a big old cowbird chick, even to the point of neglecting its own babies.
Absolutely, and some of the examples of brood parasitism are worse than that. There is some real hostility that happens here. So, like I said early on in our discussion, some parasites are very virulent and very bad for their hosts, and other parasites are not. And even among the brood parasites, we see that variation. So I'll show examples during my talk of these birds that are well known in Europe and Africa. These ones also your listeners may have heard about. They're called cuckoos,
yep.
And they're also brood parasitic. Some cuckoo species, and what they do is when their nestlings, when the babies hatch out of the egg, the baby cuckoo will eject the other eggs out of the nest. So that this baby cuckoo gets rid of all of its nest mates, and then this host, a reed warbler or something cute and little like you were talking about, is feeding this cuckoo, which actually is even much bigger than a cowbird. These are big birds getting fed by this unsuspecting host.
Wow.
My birds, the indigo birds, don't do that. They've taken a totally different strategy. They try to camouflage. So they've evolved all this elaborate mimicry so that the foster parent can't detect them, and so I'll be showing some neat photos of what that mimicry looks like.
Oh, really interesting, Chris and Stevens Point. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just curious because people, when we talk about evolution, it seems like people always assume we're talking about things taking place over billions of years or millions or hundreds of thousands of years, but it seems like there must be good examples too of like pests and fields come to mind or something where evolution could happen at a really quick rate. And
absolutely,
I'm just wondering.
Absolutely. And those are the best examples that I use for teaching about evolution, for thinking about evolution. Where we see evolution really rapidly is in the example you mentioned, like in the context of agriculture. We can see over just a few generations, the evolution of resistance to pesticides. We see in parasites that infect us, we see their evolution in response to antibiotics we use. So we see the evolution of antibiotic resistance. So evolution definitely, and even in vertebrates like fish I mentioned earlier, we can measure changes in traits like body size and armament and over within human lifetime. So it's not, it, by all means, is not over the course of billions of years. And it's, in a lot of ways, it's easier to think about it in terms of these fast evolutionary changes that we can observe.
Yeah, really interesting. Thank you, Chris. Lance in Brown Deer, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. This isn't specific to the topic, but two of the best books I've ever read about Darwin were written by Lauren Isley. And I highly recommend them. The one is just called Darwin, and the other one is Darwin's Century. Isley was a fantastic writer and researcher, and kind of gave me a background on how Darwin was working and the books he had, and on the Beagle and stuff like that, and so on. So I just wanted to kind of
throw that in. Yeah, thank you, Lauren Isley, the author. Chris, what do you think?
That's a great comment. I have not read the books that the caller mentioned, but I do remember during my college years, I started. I read one of Lauren Isley's books, and I don't even remember at this point which one. But this call is going to make me go back and reflect, because it was one of my first early inspirations in this area, along with books by other people like E.O. Wilson and Ernst Mayr, when I started getting into this natural history, the diversity of life kind of stuff. I remember reading one of Lauren Isley's books, but at this point I have no idea which book it was.
Well, he only wrote five or six.
Yeah.
But he's just an amazing author, and I highly recommend his stuff. Just a gifted author. So,
well, thank you, Lance, for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I want to give Leo in Dodgeville a chance to join in. Leo, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. This is kind of a fun thing for me. I really appreciate this. You were speaking to this easily observable evolution where it happens really fast. I think we always think of evolution as you know, over millions of years or whatever. I mean, aside from viruses or you know, things that evolve quickly. But anyway, my understanding is that there's a finch that's on the Galapagos Islands that evolves on a yearly basis based on moisture content, which affects how big or how small or how hard certain seeds are on the island. And I don't know if, I'm sure it must have been something that Darwin observed, but I was wondering how that worked, or if your guest can speak to that. It's a fascinating thing to me that can happen so quickly.
Yeah, so this is the classic example that I mentioned earlier, the Darwin's finches, but I didn't say anything about what that was all about. But Darwin's finches were among the specimens that Darwin brought back from his the voyage of the Beagle. And but actually, at first glance, he wasn't particularly interested in them because they're kind of boring looking little birds. But subsequent to that, there's been a lot of research done on these birds, a lot of it by Peter and Rosemary Grant from Princeton University. And a lot of the studies you're mentioning, these studies of seed availability, have been done over the time span of decades, and are really some of the best examples of how evolution by natural selection takes place. And again, it starts with variation. So you can imagine a bird, and you can focus on its bill. So within a population of birds, some birds have big bills and some birds have little bills. They're all within a species. They're all one species. But what turns out to happen is when hard seeds become more common, those big-billed birds have an advantage and they reproduce more, so they become more common. And that's all it is, evolution by natural selection. So it's the changes in the frequencies of these traits that are genetically controlled based on ecological selection pressures. And in this case, the selection is imposed by food availability. So when hard seeds are available, the big-billed birds do better, and when small seeds are available, the small-billed birds do better. And if the conditions change over long periods of time, that leads to this divergence that results in speciation.
Forgive me, but I guess I was I'm misinformed about it, because it seemed like it was something that would happen. Could almost happen from year to year,
No, you're absolutely right about that. The frequency, there's a slight difference. You can measure changes in bill size from year to year, and that is, in fact, evolution. So you can see these changes in bill size. The problem is that sometimes there's fluctuation in the environment. So sometimes there's a push towards big, and then sometimes there's a push back towards small. And so that can result in, over the course of longer periods of time, no change at all. So it's absolute, like you suggested, every year we do see evolution, but it doesn't always result in the formation of new species.
Ah, interesting. Thank you again, Leo, for calling. Appreciate it. Julia in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I just want to say about the speed of evolution first. I mean, this is just something about how bacteria can adapt to the problems with antibiotics, so that pretty soon the antibiotics don't work.
Mm-hmm.
But the question I had was whether the birds, which are raised by a different species, ever adopt any of that species' bird songs or habits, because I know some birds can do that.
That's a great question, and it's right in my area of interest, because the birds that I study, the indigo birds, do exactly that, and it's really kind of amazing and strange. So most songbirds, so most of the birds you see around you, sparrows and cardinals, they learn their song by copying their parents. So they hear their parents sing, and they learn how to sing. If you isolate them from their parents, they don't learn how to sing normally. So brood parasitic birds are in a very weird position because they're not being raised by their parents. And in indigo birds, what turns out to happen is that they do learn the song of their host, and male birds do sing that song as adults. It's even more interesting because they don't only sing that song. Later in life, they also pick up indigo bird song that the hosts don't sing. So as adults, they wind up with this repertoire that includes both the host song and their own indigo bird song. And so actually, when I was talking earlier about the fact that I run around the field recording songs, one of the reasons I do that is by recording indigo bird songs. That's how I know who their host was, because I can hear the song of the host in their song.
Oh.
Well, does that result in a variety of indigo birds types?
It does. It does. So each indigo bird species is associated with one host, and that song learning mechanism is critical to how that process happens. So for each indigo bird species, you can record them and you'll hear their song, and that'll tell you what nest they're raised in. And there were some experiments done in the 90s at the University of Michigan by a guy named Bob Payne, where he took indigo bird eggs and moved them to a different nest. And sure enough, those chicks would sing a different song. And the outcome of that is that this is how, you know, when that happens, those individuals will not want to mate with the same species that their parents are, because they're going to be singing different songs than their parents. And that is exactly how we think speciation, or the evolution of new species, happens in this group. We have birds that shift to different hosts based on the availability of hosts, and that leads to divergence in their song, and that prevents them from mating with other individuals that are using different hosts.
Oh, fascinating. Julia, thank you so much. And Chris, thank you so much. I want to make sure that we let people know about the event, the Darwin Day event that's coming up. Actually, it's February 6th through the 8th at the University of Wisconsin campus in the Discovery Building and Union South at the UW-Madison campus. You are speaking on Friday the 7th at
that's
7
right.
p.m.
And it starts on February 6th at 7 with what seems to be it's going to be a really fun event. Hybrid cinema, Parasites in the Movies, and then there's a series of events after that going until February 8th.
Yeah, and there's lots of interactive for children and some great interactive science booths, so it's family-friendly as well. And I know your presentation is going to be great. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. And if anyone wants more information on the event, you can just Google Darwin Day 2014 Madison, and you'll find all about the alien invasions. It was really great talking to you.
Thanks, Chris. And again, it's up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can just click there, and I will direct you right to all of the events. Thanks for listening. Scott Craven joins us tomorrow here on the Ideas Network.